certified in family medicine, but perhaps more importantly, in this regard, is that he has held the X waiver license, or the X license to prescribe buprenorphine for many years now, and has tremendous experience in this area. And so, Dr. Bertoli, are you there? Take it away.
I'm here. Thank you, Marshall. I must say that I went to medical school so long ago that actually GW was relatively cheap compared to now. So those loans are all paid off. And I was in the National Public Health Service Corps and did a couple of years to get those loans retired. So anyway, thank you for asking me to talk. I'm going to discuss predominantly the buprenorphine, naloxone aspect of medication-assisted treatment. There are other medications, including methadone and naltrexone, which I'll mention briefly, but the vast majority of what we're going to talk about is a very practical way that I have, I think, introduced a MAT program into community health clinics. So I think everybody is aware, you can go next slide. Everybody's aware that there is a huge opioid epidemic in our country. They haven't spared anybody. All of us have patients and clients who struggle with pain. Sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's emotional, sometimes it's both. And you know, one of our fundamental responsibilities is to treat the pain, but also to do no harm. So a little bit of history. In the 1990s, pain was considered the fifth vital sign. You can see it there. We took patients' blood pressure, pulse, respiratory rate, and temperature, and we also asked in the 90s how much pain people were having, and it became a very important part of patient care in this pain management, and it became a very important part of patient satisfaction. Next slide. So a lot of the issues around opioid prescribing were the products of our efforts to improve patient care. I remember times when doctors got called to task if they didn't give patients enough pain medicine. And that's obviously now run full circle. So historically, opium from poppy seeds, first used around 1500 BC, it's been around a long time. It was treated, opium was used for pain and insomnia. And at the beginning of the 19th century, the first opiate, morphine, was used to treat pain. And believe it or not, it was used to treat addiction. We go decades later, Bayer marketed heroin, or synthesized heroin from morphine, and marketed it for cough and respiratory illnesses, as both tuberculosis and pneumonia were major health issues then. Next. So what's happened, though, is that the non-medical use of prescription opioids in the 21st century, that's called diversion, obviously, actually decreased between those 10 years, the 2003 to 2013. But the prevalence of prescription use disorders, frequency of use, and opioid mortality actually increased. So that in 2010, enough opioids were sold in the United States for every adult to receive 5 milligrams of hydrocodone every 4 hours for a month. The use of opioids has progressed to misuse, abuse, addiction, and overdose. And no one, either rich or poor, educated or not, successful or living in the streets, has been spared. Each day this year, 44 people die from an overdose of prescription opioids. And this doesn't address even the non-prescription heroin use and people who, you know, find it on the street. This number now outpaces deaths from motor vehicle accidents by 50%. Obviously, when used appropriately for trauma, injury, cancer, end-of-life care, opioids can really help people tremendously. Next slide. But we want to get away from prescribing these medications as much as we do, and there are all other kinds of modalities of care that are healthier, safer, and can ease pain. And they're listed there. You know, physical therapy, acupuncture, chiropractic, yoga, massage, meditation, biofeedback, CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. I can tell you that Marshall and I do a lot of our relaxation that help us stay sane by going fishing, and that's a picture up in the Rockies of British Columbia on a beautiful stream. And I can tell you that I have a terrible back, but and I don't take opioids for it. But after I go fishing for a week, it doesn't hurt for about 3 weeks after that. So it's a good therapy for me. There's also lots of other medications that people use, including NSAIDs, some seizure meds, gabapentine, naltrexone, methadone, and the buprenorphine naloxone that we're going to talk about today. Next, I just want to mention really briefly about methadone, because there have been lots of methadone clinics in the past that have been used to treat addicts. There's a big, big difference between methadone and buprenorphine naloxone. Methadone, first of all, is a full agonist as opposed to a partial agonist. We'll explain that down the road here. The problem with methadone is that it has a very, very long half-life and no ceiling effect. So a ceiling, when a medication doesn't have a ceiling effect, it means that the desired effect you're looking for increases with the dose, but the side effects worsen or start to be dangerous. So what happens with methadone is that it's in your system long after its pain properties are gone. And so oftentimes people require more and more methadone to get an incremental effect. But then as they use more and more of it, it becomes more dangerous. I read a study that showed that of all opioids, methadone was only 5% of those prescribed. It caused up to 33% of overdose deaths. That's as opposed to buprenorphine naloxone, which does have a ceiling effect. So a ceiling effect would be an example of diminishing returns. That's a phenomenon in which a drug reaches a maximum effect. So the increase in the dosage doesn't increase its effectiveness. So it has a much better safety profile. Next slide.
Dr. Bertoli, so this is Dr. Kubota. Why, just to clarify, why is the naloxone put in there as well?
Okay, we're going to talk a lot about that, Marshall, when we talk about what it does and how it works. So just, we'll talk about that a lot, if you could just hold on, okay? Next slide. So I've been prescribing buprenorphine naloxone for about the last 5.5-6 years. I have an X license, and we'll also talk about how you get your X license to prescribe. But at MCHC in UKIA, we managed 90 to 100 patients with a team that included a nurse case manager and a drug and alcohol counselor. I now continue to offer it not only to those addicted, but to those who have chronic pain and are overusing. And I want to tell you about one particular patient that I recently treated. He was a man, we'll call him Chris, not his real name, in his 30s. I think he fell off a roof 7 or 8 years ago and injured his back. And he was prescribed opioid. He was prescribed oxycodone for that problem. And in increasing amounts. To the point where he got up to about 10 milligram oxycodones a day and still said that his pain was not being relieved. He also is an insulin-dependent diabetic, and he has terrible neuropathy. He's a chef now. He's on his feet all day, and he has terrible neuropathic pain in his feet that often keep him awake at night. So he came to me and he said, you know, he had heard about that I use buprenorphine naloxone. And so I had him come in for treatment for it, and we gave him a very small dose, and within probably half an hour, he said that he felt better than he'd ever felt in the last 10 years. All of his pain in his back was gone. All of his neuropathy was gone, and he's not the first person I've tried this for who have terrible neuropathy. It seems to work really well for people with diabetes or other. I had one guy who was an alcoholic who had neuropathy, and it helped him tremendously. So he lived about 7 miles from the clinic, and he told me that he felt well enough to walk home. That's how good he felt. I saw him in follow-up last week, actually, and he continues to do well. And one of the beauties of buprenorphine with naloxone is that, in general, it doesn't make people euphoric. So oftentimes what they'll tell you is that they just feel normal. So, you know, it doesn't work on everybody, but when it does work, it's very effective. Next slide. So let's talk a little bit before we go into Suboxone about dopamine. Dopamine is the feel-good chemical in our brains. It's what allows us to get up in the morning, drink our coffee, go to work, do our daily routine. The average brain produces about 50 nanograms per deciliter of dopamine per day. On a good day, probably the best day of your life, maybe that goes up to 100 nanograms. Substances like tobacco, THC, heroin really boost that dopamine level. With tobacco, it's about 450 nanograms. With marijuana, about 650. And with heroin, 975. People who use methamphetamine can spike their dopamine level up to 1,100 nanograms per day. So it's about at least 10 times better than the best day of your life. And this is where that whole notion of chasing the high comes from. Because as people start to use or abuse opioids, the body produces less dopamine. And what starts to happen is cravings, similar to those individuals who are either starving or dehydrated. In fact, what's interesting, there was one study done where people were deprived water for 3 days, and then some functional MRI was done of their brain, and the part of the brain that wanted water lit up like a baseball. They did another study where people were deprived food for 3 days and did the MRI, and that part of the brain that wanted food lit up like a basketball. If you deprive people of their opioid after 30 days, the MRI lights up like the equivalent of a baseball field. So that's how important this is to us, as the dopamine levels. So opioid substitution therapies like buprenorphine and methadone both raise dopamine levels, but they raise them only to normal levels. So that's why these drugs are important, and that's why they don't cause these highs. Next slide. Just want to be clear about what we're talking about. There's a big difference between addiction and dependence. So I don't need to read all this, but it's on the slide. Addiction is a primary chronic disease of the brain. It messes with motivation, memory, and all the circuitry. Obviously, addiction is a dysfunctional condition, but it's characterized by those 5 points below. Craving is absolutely one of the hallmarks of addiction. But people who can't, abstain, there's behavioral issues, people start to not understand significant problems in their life, and they often respond with a dysfunctional emotional response. Next slide. So here's the difference. Physical dependence is we rely on that external source of opioids to prevent withdrawal, but we can get rid of that if we slowly taper the opioid. Endorphins, which, the root there is endogenous morphine, we produce some of that to prevent withdrawal, but as tolerance increases and dose of the opioid increases, our ability to maintain the equilibrium is exceeded, and we become dependent on the external source. Addiction is abnormal and classified as a disease, and this uncontrollable craving, the inability to control the drug use, compulsive drug use, and use despite doing harm or self to others is a hallmark. Next slide. We can be dependent on lots of substances. Caffeine, nicotine, and sugar are just a few. And we expect that people will become dependent on opioids, but that's a distraction from the real problem, which is addiction. The addiction and the cravings are rooted in altered brain biology. Recovery is the process of reversing, to that extent possible, those brain changes. And that takes time. Most people think that that takes probably 18 to 24 months. So people come to you and want to try Suboxone for a few weeks or a month and then get off it because they have every good intention to get off all opioids, usually doesn't work. I think we have to be really clear about the difference between dependency and addiction. We call addiction opioid dependence, substance dependence, opioid use disorder, but just calling it dependence, I think, leads to a lot of confusion. Next slide. Okay, so who do we give the buprenorphine naloxone to? Chronic pain patients can be prescribed buprenorphine naloxone, and it can be done without the X license as long as the diagnosis is chronic pain. Both mid-levels and MDs can dispense under that diagnosis. But in general, we want to have the following criteria: a positive DSM-5 score of 2 or greater, a positive DAS for opioids of 6 or greater, or the SAMHSA guidelines, which are 1 year history of opioid use disorder prior to the use of methadone. I don't follow the strict criteria. I will often use it in patients with chronic pain, and I've had a lot of success with that. But it doesn't work in everybody. I think my batting average is between two-thirds and about 75%, which is still, I think, a lot higher than what you'd get just from abstinence. Next slide. This is the DSM-5 criteria, so you need a score of 2 to 3 or greater on this one. This comes right out of the book, and you can see there all the criteria for what gives you a point. I don't think I have to repeat that. The drug abuse screening tools, 10-item brief screening tool, can be administered very quickly. And you have to get a score of at least 6 on this to meet the requirement. Next slide. These are the questions. You get 1 point for each. If you score 6 out of the 10 or greater, then that's considered positive. And I think that Danny will be sending these around to you if they're hard to see on the screen. Is that right, Danny?
Yeah, I will be.
Okay. So interpreting the DAS, 6 to 8 is considered intensive assessment needed and suggested action with things like buprenorphine and naloxone. Okay, next slide. So what is this drug and how does it work or not work? So buprenorphine is a partial mu opioid agonist. It has high affinity for and slow dissociation from the receptor. And it's combined with naloxone, an opioid antagonist. So this speaks to Marshall's question about why the naloxone is in there. Naloxone, if you recall, isn't absorbed by the GI tract. So taking the buprenorphine as a film or a pill, the naloxone doesn't work at all. But lots of people who have this addiction problem will either grind up the buprenorphine and naloxone, or they'll melt it and inject it. And then, remember, naloxone's the antagonist, so it bumps all of the opioid off the receptor, so the drug won't work. Buprenorphine has a greater affinity for the opioid receptor than just about any other opioid. So this is the reason why when people have dependency or addiction issues, they have to be in some withdrawal before they come in for induction to get the buprenorphine. If they're not in withdrawal and they just took an opioid, then what's going to happen is the buprenorphine will go to the receptor and fight the other drug for gaining hold of that receptor. And what happens is both of the drugs come off the receptor. And then what happens is you're throwing somebody into withdrawal. And you do that, it precipitates an immediate withdrawal. So people can be very, very ill. This has happened a couple of times where people have told me that, you know, they haven't taken their medication, their opioids in a few days. We do what's called a CALS, which we'll get to, a clinical opioid withdrawal scale. They're not really in much withdrawal, they're in a little bit. And we give them the buprenorphine, and it makes them very sick. So you got to make sure that people are in withdrawal when you give them the drug. So the naloxone is in buprenorphine. There's another MAT drug called naltrexone. And naltrexone is a longer-acting antagonist. It comes in pills that you take daily, but it also comes in a injectable form that's given monthly. And lots of times, people coming out of jail have been ordered to be on naltrexone by judges. They have to be completely free of any opioid, probably for 7 days, that's what the package insert says, before they get the naltrexone. The naltrexone injection is 380 milligrams once a month. And it works both for alcohol and for opioids as a way to limit cravings and desires. It doesn't treat pain. It only treats the craving because it occupies the space on the opioid receptor. So is that clear, Marshall? Is that
pretty, I think so. The issue of using buprenorphine for pain, we're going to probably take that up at a later date. I know there are a lot of questions about that, but it's still this issue of not doing a rapid swap over, you know, you're on oxycodone and I want to put you on buprenorphine and you just swap one for the other is a potentially dangerous thing to do. So this is you probably should go through the training regardless, don't you think so?
Yeah, I absolutely, because I think, and when I talked to Corey Waller, who's a chronic pain specialist in Michigan, he uses the buprenorphine naloxone on everybody. He doesn't give people buprenorphine. Although, if you read the literature, buprenorphine has been used in Europe for chronic pain for a long, long time. I don't know if they have the same, you know, addiction issues we do. Here are the forms of buprenorphine and naloxone. It comes as films in those doses, tablets, patches. There's a buccal film now. And believe it or not, I didn't put it in the slide because it just came out, but the Food and Drug Administration just approved an implant for the treatment of opioid disorder. It's four little matchstick-sized rods that get implanted in the upper arm, and it secretes a low dose of buprenorphine for 6 months. It's recommended only in patients who are already stable on buprenorphine and in having just low to moderate doses. You know, it has much less potential for abuse, obviously, although I'm sure there are cases where an addict could dig those rods out of their arm and use them in another way. It's also quite expensive. And people will ask about the cost of buprenorphine naloxone. In general, 16 milligrams a day, which is two films or two pills, which is about the most we ever give, is about $12. So 30 days of that's $360, and then you have to add some doctor visits in there, or provider visits, so it comes up to about $500 a month. The company that makes the rods is saying that they're going to be competitive with other injectable forms of things like naltrexone. So that could cost as much as $1,000 a day. I don't know what the cost is, but I think it's going to be quite expensive. So anyway, that's just a little, that's the latest, that now there's an implantable form of this, which I think has got some real promise. So when they did the studies on this, 12% of people on the rods still abused other opioids versus about 28% of people who were taking the film or the tablet. So it did decrease diversion and other kinds of misuse by a significant amount. So next slide.
Yeah, and for the listening audience, this is Dr. Kubota again. So all these forms of buprenorphine available or not through Medi-Cal are carve-outs to the state of California. So partnership never sees these prescriptions or claims because they take their 180-degree turn away from partnership's pharmacy at the level of the retail pharmacy if that's where the drugs are being dispensed. So it goes through their TAR process and authorization process and not partnerships.
We haven't had any problems getting them approved, though, I can tell you that. I think that, you know, if you document the patient's problem and put the right diagnosis in, it's never been an issue. So that's been my experience anyway. Okay, so what do you do? How do you start all this? What's the workflow? How do you screen people? What do you do? I think this is, it's very important that you do this with a team approach. We use basically a case manager that's ideally an RN. We use a behavioral health provider, and it's ideal if that person has some training in alcohol and as an alcohol and drug counselor, although that's not absolutely necessary. And we use the first visit. What happens actually is the patient will call in, the intake is done by the case manager. We don't get paid for that. We just ask a lot of questions about their, you know, what they've been doing, what's been going on in their life, what they've been taking. And then they're scheduled to see the behavioral health counselor, who does kind of an evaluation for readiness. You know, what's your motivation to do this? Why do you want to get off these drugs now? And does sort of the psychosocial part of the evaluation. I think what you have to remember, though, is that we want to also give people the benefit of the doubt. Addiction's a disease. You know, it has a stigma attached to it, but it's still a disease. And so most of the time, we don't reject people out of hand from starting the program. That visit is usually a 30-minute visit, and then they see somebody like me, a provider with an X license, who does the medical comprehensive screening. It's an ideal time, I think, to do a physical exam in lab, which might include Hep C, HIV, STD, CMP, CBC, just because it's an opportunity to do some health care on people who often haven't had any primary care in quite a while. So that's also a 30-minute visit. We do drug screens, urine drug screens, on every visit. And there's two basic ways you can do that. You can get point-of-care screening, which screens for just about all the opioids and THC and all those things. And that's a good test. It's not as sensitive as the send-outs, which go to the San Diego Reference Lab. But I think the point about the point-of-care that's great is that if you see things in there and people are lying to you or not telling you all the things they're taking, you can go back to them and say, wait a minute, you told me you didn't do, you know, benzodiazepines, and here there's benzos in your urine. What's up with that? And so it's a more immediate way to sort of figure out what's going on with somebody. If you send it out, it obviously takes a few days to get back to you. So we go through this process, intake, BH, medical visit, and most of the time we approve people to come back for induction. If they take high-dose methadone above 90 milligrams, it's important that you wean them down from that because there's mixed results with the buprenorphine naloxone if they're on more than 90 milligrams. But once the decision is made to treat, you pick a date, you write a prescription that they can pick up at the pharmacy, or you have a supply of the drug in your office. Generally, it's bigger clinics that have pharmacies where the can be safely stored. The other thing about writing the prescription is that oftentimes I'll say that, and I'll write a note on the prescription, that they can't pick up the prescription until the morning of their induction. And I learned the hard way that I had a patient who I wrote the prescription for a week before the induction, and he got the prescription, but then he took off. So I kind of got tricked on that one. So we often schedule the appointment at 10 o'clock in the morning, the induction. We usually do the inductions in the morning. We want people to pick their drug up like that morning, and usually pharmacies are open by 9, so they can do that right before their induction. Okay, next slide.
Dr. Bertola, when it comes to having a supply in the office, you may have mentioned, do you have to have an in-house pharmacy, or is it like, for instance, other stock medications?
Well, it's a Schedule II drug, so you know, if you have other stock and you have a way to lock it, you can have it in your office. You just have to make sure that you keep, you know, adequate records like you would for any other opioid. And we'll get to that because you can be checked on that sort of thing by the SAMHSA people. So you can have it in your office. So before we give it, we want an informed consent, and I sent Danielle our informed consent. It's about 6 pages, and it is specific to buprenorphine. It explains the drug, it explains our responsibilities, and it explains the patient's responsibilities, and it's very clearly spelled out. We had sort of a rule about 3 strikes and you're out, so that if people had, you know, little problems with taking other drugs, or other drugs were found in their urine, or they didn't show up on time for their appointments, or any other sort of slip-up, we generally have that all detailed in the informed consent. And I think that Danielle will probably send that out to what we used as an informed consent. It was specifically written by me and our case manager for buprenorphine. I think it's very important that patients have BH backup. I think they should be referred for CBT, individual counseling, 12-step programs, whatever it takes. But I think that it's very important that behavioral health care continues. And we'll talk a little bit more about, there's a couple of ways to do it in group settings as well. I think we also, I talk a lot with patients about contingencies. So what happens if this person has every good intention to stay off all their opioids and they find themselves in situations where there's a lot of temptation? You know, they're at a party or they're at the bar with their friends and somebody says, why don't you just try this? You know, why don't you just take this other drug? How do they manage that? So those situations are always going to come up in people's lives. And I think sort of thinking about it ahead of time and talking about what you can do about it with people in a very practical way is important. You know, so people are going to crave their drug, that chasing the high. They remember how good they felt when they were on those high doses of opioids, you know. And you can almost expect that people are going to slip up once in a while. But remember, if you think about it as a disease and you don't beat them up about it, I think it's really important. I think if you partner with people and you create a relationship where you understand how hard this is for people to do, it really helps. And they sort of see you as an ally. I think you have to get to the place where you speak very frankly with people about all these things. And, you know, you're kind of the mentor. I mean, we used to say that my case manager was mom and I was dad. And, you know, lots of addicts get away with stuff. They're impulsive. They can't sit with their own pain or their own sort of anxiety. And so they immediately want relief from that. And I think you have to almost expect that's going to happen. Next slide. So I use, when people come in for induction, I use 2 scales. I use the conversion table, the morphine equivalent dose. There's a lot of controversy about that right now, about whether that's real, those things are really equivalent, but I don't know what else to use, so that's what I use, and I think it's on one of the next slides. And then when people come in to get induced, we always administer the clinical opioid withdrawal scale because it gives us an indication of where they are in their withdrawal. So either they have to be in withdrawal, or they have to have nothing in their urine, or, you know, no other opioid. Otherwise, you would not give them the buprenorphine. Next slide. My standard is to give the first dose in the office. This is the induction that we're talking about. So when you're flipping from the full opioid agonist to the buprenorphine naloxone, you want the UDS negative or mild to moderate withdrawal on the cows. You can give up to 8-2 buprenorphine naloxone if the drug screen is negative. I use, for induction, almost always we use the films. And the films come as a couple of different doses, but generally I use the 8-2, and people can cut it and cut it anywhere they want, and it still works, and it's still, you know, if you cut it in half, you get 4-1. If you cut it in fours, you get 2.5. I usually start low. I start, if they're positive, with 2.5 or 4-1. You can always give more, but you can't take it away. And you can make people sick if you give them too much. So we then observe them in the office. I've never had to give anybody 24-6. I've had to give people up to 16-4 to get rid of their withdrawal. And what you do is every 20 or 30 minutes, you do a CAL score again, and you watch that withdrawal just go away. And my friend Chris, who I told you about the example we used, within a half an hour, he said he felt better than he'd felt in 10 years. He had no withdrawal, and it managed both his neuropathic pain and his back pain. Next slide. So we tell people 24 to 72 hours of no opioids. That's hard for a lot of people because usually these people are taking the drugs every day and they go into withdrawal, generally within 12 to 18 hours. Ideally, you'd like them 3 days off all of the opioids, but that sometimes can't be accomplished. We use clonidine, promethazine, and ondansetron to treat the withdrawal. You know, people get anxious, they get nauseous, they get cramps, they get goosebumps, they get tachycardic, they can't sit still. Those are all signs of withdrawal that are well documented on the CALS. So what we do is we find an optimum dose that seems to take away both their withdrawal and their pain. And because, you know, the buprenorphine naloxone has a fairly long half-life, you literally can treat once or twice a day. But so many of these people are used to taking drugs all day long that as soon as they feel a little bit of pain or a little bit of withdrawal, they want to go back to taking it. So oftentimes, what I'll prescribe is a full day's dose and have them divided up in four doses. You know, BID is adequate, as it says there, but sometimes you have to give it more often. And what people start to realize is they forget about their pain and they forget about their withdrawal. And oftentimes, you know, they get to the place where they only take it once or twice a day. Next slide. So you can do other things as a bridge to the buprenorphine naloxone. I've had quite a few people who couldn't even go 8 hours without taking drugs. Generally, it's been people who have been addicted to heroin, but some other people, you know, on pills can't do it either. So what you have to realize is that buprenorphine by itself comes as a patch called Butrans. And you can place that patch on the skin. It takes 36 hours to peak. So they're getting a little bit of the buprenorphine as time passes, and so they don't really have a lot of withdrawal. And then after 36 hours, you can take it off and then give them the buprenorphine naloxone strips. So I've done that before with good success on people who couldn't tolerate withdrawal. You can also use all the other things we use for withdrawal if they have some, you know, the clonidine, promethazine, and ondansetron. Next slide. I haven't done this, just so you know. I think it's a little dangerous, but I've talked to people who have also used a fentanyl bridge where you put a morphine equivalent patch on the skin. They come back 3 days later, you remove the patch, and then you give the buprenorphine and naloxone. You watch them, make sure there's no withdrawal, and you have them take their first dose of buprenorphine and naloxone when they go into withdrawal. Next slide. I just think, well, this is a conversion table. This is what I use. You can see it's really pretty strong. 1.2 milligrams of buprenorphine, which is about less than a quarter of an 8 milligram strip, is equivalent to 30 to 60 milligrams of morphine. So it's quite strong. And the mistake I've made early on was that I prescribed too much buprenorphine. So I go really slow now. I read an article last week about how this conversion table is a bunch of hooey and isn't really accurate, but it's all we got right now. You know, everybody metabolizes things differently, I suppose. And I don't know if you've seen that sort of thing lately, Marshall, but I know Partnership is talking about prescribing opioids in no more than 120 milligram equivalents of morphine. And I think you've talked about getting that down to 90. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that's the current CDC recommendations. And many of the community groups that have come together around this are choosing the 90. Our 120 was, you know, based upon data that we had available 2 years ago. What happens if you give too much buprenorphine?
People get sick. They don't get high necessarily, but they feel sick. People have said that they, you know, feel sick to their stomach. They don't feel well. They just feel like they've overdosed on something. It doesn't really cause a lot of respiratory depression at these doses, unless it's associated with other medications on board, such as benzodiazepines. The only deaths that have occurred have been in people who are abusing multiple drugs with it. So it's pretty safe, but people just don't feel well. The other reason it often doesn't work is because it does alleviate the withdrawal and it does take away the pain. It's a very good pain medicine, but people miss the high. They don't get euphoric because it's only a partial opioid agonist. It doesn't raise those dopamine levels way up. And so people don't feel high. And so they say, oh, this isn't working, you know. But I don't know what to do about that. I mean, it's, you know, as I said, our batting average is about 70%. So
that's part of the selection process, I assume.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there are some people who, you know, take these drugs and can't stand them. They take one or two. I have a partner who fell down and broke her wrist, and she took two oxycodone after a four-hour surgery and hated it and went to Advil, you know. And there are other people who that's the beginning of them getting hooked on opioids, is they have an injury, and it just it feels good to take these drugs, and pretty soon they're hooked on it. I don't know how well you can all see this, but this is the clinical opioid, the COW scale, the withdrawal scale. And I like to see people in at least moderate withdrawal, which is a score of 13 to 24, moderate to moderately severe. If people are in mild withdrawal, you can give the buprenorphine naloxone, but it's not quite as effective, I think. So anyway, that's a COW. And Danielle's going to send everybody this COW score. So you can see those columns over on the right. We do the COW score when people come in and withdraw to be induced. We give them the buprenorphine naloxone, and then in about 20 minutes, we check the score again. I like the score doesn't have to go to zero, but I sure would like it to be very mild, like probably five or less, before you know you've given an adequate amount of buprenorphine. And, you know, you can't keep people in your office all day, so often most of the time these people are way down within 45 minutes or an hour. And you don't have to continuously monitor them. You can go see another patient while, you know, the drug is working. But I use this COW score every time somebody comes in withdrawal before I induce them. Okay, next slide. So how do we monitor people? So we do the induction. That usually takes, they're in your office for an hour and a half or so. I almost always see people the next week because I want to make sure, first of all, that there's no diversion, that there's nothing else in their urine, drugs, other drugs, alcohol. We have a very strict no benzo policy, and people who are on long-term benzos, we actively taper them. And I don't think you can go from, you know, 3 or 4 1-milligram Xanax a day to nothing, but over a couple of weeks or months, we get them off their benzos. What do you do about THC? That's a big issue. You know, I've tried to legislate it, and just about everybody who comes in this area, especially where we work in Mendocino County, uses marijuana. And I've kind of given up on trying to, because you basically have to throw everybody out of your program. Just about everybody is on THC. Ideally, when you talk to people like Waller in Michigan, he has a more strict policy than we do. But we talk to them every time about trying to limit its use. That's all I think you can do in this area. I don't think it adds to the danger of taking Suboxone. And some people are smoking or using every day. So our rule is three strikes and you're out. If you have slip-ups three times in a row, usually we think you're not ready for the program, and we have people go to AODP, or we say, you know, let's do some intense BH counseling and come back in 6 months. Sometimes, you know, depending on the circumstance, because this is a disease, we let people slide and we try to get them, you know, back in the program. Oftentimes people will be absolutely perfect for 6 months or 8 months, and then on that ninth month they come in and there's something else in their urine. And what we do with that is just shorten the tether. We have them come in more often. And I've seen people sometimes every day to give them their drug because I didn't trust that they would stay clean without it. So generally we see them once or twice weekly, then we see them monthly for 6 months, every other month from 6 to 12 months, and every 3 months after a year. Compliance means no diversion, clean urine drug screen, on time, you make it to all your appointments, all the groups, all the BH meetings. And you know, the hallmark of an addict is they will make excuses for things, and you don't allow any excuses. You have to be firm but fair, you have to be compassionate, you have to expect people are going to slip up. But, you know, you got to be tough sometimes, but you have to do it in a fair and compassionate way. Next slide. So long term, you know, most of the neuronal stabilization is going to take a year and a half to two. Having said that, I mean, I have patients who have been in the program for 5 or 6 years. They're gainfully employed, they have good relationships, they're back together with their family, they're contributing members of society again, and you say, hey, how about we wean you or try and wean you off this drug now? Because it seems like you have some tools in your belt so that when things come up, you know, you're going to be okay. I've had some people say to me, if you take me off this drug, I will be back on heroin tomorrow. I have other patients who say, yeah, let's do that. And you have to do it in a very slow, patient-driven sort of way, and with encouragement. I have some people who they will wean completely off the buprenorphine naloxone, except they want one of those strips in their back pocket, almost like a security blanket or a teddy bear. And they don't ever necessarily use it, but they want it there just in case. And I don't have a problem with that. We continue to ask people to come to behavioral health either in a group situation or individually for the long term, just to check in. I think that's also very important. And I think, as I said a bunch of times, we're batting about 70%. Next slide. So here's the regulatory requirements. There's a data, SAMHSA has administered this data, Drug Addiction Treatment Act 2000 waiver. You have to have an X license to prescribe buprenorphine naloxone. It takes an 8-hour course online to qualify. But let me tell you, after I took that course, I didn't really know much about this drug and didn't really understand how it worked. It was really with a clinical experience that I learned a lot more about it. The SAMHSA, the Drug Data 2000 waiver, requires that you keep an active list of all your patients past and present. It's overseen by the DEA. They don't have a lot of resources, but they visit. They can visit annually. Most offices are in compliance. Some have minor record-keeping problems. Next. So this is what you need to give the DEA if they show up at your office. You have to show them your waiver. You have to show them treatment logs. You have to document all your prescriptions. And you have to show them what your dispensing practices are if you have it in your office. So in other words, they want to know that it's locked up, that you know somebody has control of it, all that sort of thing. I have never been audited. Just maybe my time is soon, but I haven't been audited yet. Next slide. So when you write prescriptions, you know, there are no special guidelines. It is a Schedule II drug. You can refill it up to 5 times, although I never do that. And you have to show your XDEA number on the prescription. You don't have to do that if it's for an off-label use, like chronic pain, and you don't have to put your X number on the prescription, and it doesn't count against the number of patients you can have if it's off-label use. The patient is your patient and is considered under your care for the duration of the last prescription. So if somebody comes and you give a prescription for 3 months and then you never see them again, you're on the hook for that 3 months that you prescribed it for. And after that, they're not considered your patient anymore. Next slide. So here's who we use as our clinical support team. The LVN or RN is the case manager, does the intake, fields questions, deals that issues come up between appointments, prepares the huddle. We do a huddle before all group visits, and we do that with the case manager, the behavioral health therapist, and the provider. And then I think we already talked about the BH therapist. I think that other patients actually help. It's really hard to get people all at one stage in a group, but when we did group visits, which we'll talk about in a minute, I thought that people who had been in the program, who had really, you know, suffered or struggled with being staying on the straight and narrow, really helped some of the younger people in the group. There's also a risk there that some people tend to take over the group, so it's important that the BH therapist who runs the group can kind of manage that. But I really think other, you know, as much as all the providers may know about the drug, most of us haven't been opioid dependent or struggled with this. So having somebody else who can talk about that struggle with people, I think, is really important. Next slide.
Dr. Bertoli, so some of our clinics are pretty small. Do you think this is a potential for a go-alone provider, or, you know, and if you had to pick two, well, you have to have the prescriber in the above. What do you do? We're looking at the real resource.
So a couple days a week I work in a small clinic in Laytonville, and we have a BH, LCSW, and we have some nursing staff, and we have me. And I have prescribed this, but I've sort of insisted that people go to a counselor. And the nurses and I kind of share that case manager job. So you can do it in a small place. Obviously, it'd be hard to have 90 to 100 patients, but then in a small place, you're probably not going to have that many anyway. You know. So yeah, I think it's doable in a small place, Marshall. I think that
Thank
works.
You.
Yeah, next. Okay, so here's how it's done. You know, we do the intake over the phone. The case manager can't bill. The BH person sees the patient to determine psychological readiness. The provider then sees them at a different appointment because you can't bill twice on the same day. Does all those things, including lab work. Explains what buprenorphine is. Prescribes withdrawal meds. And then approves the patient or not for induction. We disapprove very few people, because we want to give them the benefit of the doubt. We've kicked some people out, but we generally approve them. Next. We always see them a week after induction to evaluate the dose. Sometimes we'll change the dose. Sometimes it goes down. Often it goes up just a little bit. We talk about cravings, side effects, slip-ups, all those sorts of things. And then ideally, in a bigger place, we see them 2 weeks after induction in a group visit with a behavioral counselor, although that could be done individually as well. But I think it's really important in that it's written into your agreement that the patient is willing to see a counselor. That is really critical in this, in the therapy, I think. Next. So then we go to every month for 6 months if they're stable, every other month for 6 to 12, and every 3 months thereafter. Slip-ups occur, then you just increase the visits to more frequently. I've often referred people to drug and alcohol AODP programs or another more intensive drug treatment program, including inpatient programs, for people who just can't, you know, follow the rules. And there's, you know, it's a minority of people, but some people need that. Next. So Marshall asked me to talk a little bit about the financial case because everybody's busy and we're all trying to see a lot of patients in our office. Most of the visits are short visits after those two upfront longer ones with the BH and the MDDO. Once they're in the program, they're scheduled for 15 minutes. Group visits, generally the most number of patients in a group would be 10 to 12. And then what happens is each of those patients is taken out of the group for short 5 to 7 minute visits. I think that's on the next slide. But you take them out and the provider talks to them and changes the dose, refills the dose, decides what's next. But I could frequently see 10 or 12 patients in about 90 minutes, and you can bill for all of those. So it becomes relatively financially doable. I think that when they're in your office for induction, you know, you're seeing other people simultaneously because you're giving them the medicine and then observing them every 20 or 30 minutes. So you don't have to see them exclusively. So that's how that works. The Data 2000 X license costs $200. Marshall, you can talk about your inducements and whether or not you're paying for that. I think you are, right, to have providers sign up?
What we're doing is it's in the QIP. It's a one-time $500 pay-for-performance up to five providers, and in this case, MDs, or MDs DOs per site. Do you allow, or is it allowed to have other non-prescribing, non-X license to do some of the maintenance work under your prescribing license?
Right. I think the RN did a lot of that under my prescribing license, but we would talk back and forth all day. It just became more efficient for the provider who is prescribing to actually do the work, you know, and you have to, as the X license holder, you have to sign all the prescriptions. It can't be done by a mid-level, somebody who doesn't have an X license, except if it's for chronic or another diagnosis.
Well, that's good to know. And I take it at your group visit, that is the only business of the day for that visit in order to get through all the people in the group.
No, we would have our huddle at 2 o'clock for half an hour. We'd have everybody show up by 2:30. They're required, all the patients, to stay in the office for an hour. And usually by 3:30 or quarter to 4, I was done with those 10 to 12 patients, including doing all the work in the EHR, because we developed a template just for this. And I could get through it all, and then between quarter to 4 and 5 or 5:30, I could see more patients. So I'd often, on those afternoons or those mornings, you know, we'd start at 9 in the morning session, I could see, you know, 17 or 18 patients. So, you know, it wasn't, and it felt like it was relatively easy to do that because we had this model that we were using, you know. And I got a lot of help from the BH people and the case manager. So I don't think you see fewer patients, but, you know, you could see 10 or 12 patients and in the afternoon and be done in 2 hours, too, if you wanted to be done. So, and not see anybody else. So I don't think it's, I mean, I think the hard, why don't you just go to the next slide, we can talk a little bit more about, you know, how the difficulties I think this is really sort of important. I think I have actually gotten some of the most satisfaction from doing this because you see patients really change. You see people who are anxious, impulsive, can't sit still, you know, have no thoughtfulness about the future. And over the course of 6 months or so, you really begin to see them change. You know, they're down and out, they've lost their families, they've been in jail, they've been looking for this drug on the street, it's the best lover they've ever had, and now you've turned that around or helped them turn that around. And I think it's incredibly satisfying to sit with those people who you developed a relationship with and you've actually seen them transition to making healthy choices. And, You know it's happening when they say to you, you know, I was at a party the other day, and I got, you know, somebody came up to me and said, why don't you take this? And I said, no. And you say to them, well, why'd you say no? And they said, well, because I know that in the moment, maybe I would feel high, or I would feel better, I would feel, you know, different. But then tomorrow morning, I would wake up, and I'd be right back where I was 6 months ago. And at that point, you know they've actually, they're on the road to recovery, you know. The other thing you should know, which I didn't mention back in how the, should have mentioned this, about the way the buprenorphine naloxone works is, because the buprenorphine naloxone holds on so tightly to the receptor, if you give any other opioid, it's not going to work. Because, well, the converse isn't true, which is why they have to be in withdrawal. So in other words, if you're taking an opioid, if you just took oxycodone and I gave you buprenorphine naloxone, that would precipitate withdrawal. But if you're on buprenorphine naloxone and I gave you an oxycodone, nothing would happen, because the buprenorphine won't allow that oxycodone onto the receptor. And what we found clinically is that somebody on these drugs, buprenorphine naloxone, will go to the ER with a broken leg. And lots of ER doctors don't know how this drug works, and they'll give the patient Dilaudid or morphine or some other drug for their broken leg, and the patient says, I don't feel any different, it doesn't work. So, you know, it really blocks the receptor from any other drug. And, you know, I think that's an important thing to understand about it. And it's really important that we sort of train, we train some of the ER doctors about that. So, anyway. That's the satisfaction I get out of it. It really, because some of these people are so down and out when you see them, and you really see them change. And they're incredibly appreciative for what you've done, because their lives are often in shambles. You know, it's all around obtaining the drug on the street, or, you know, they're always worried they're going to be in withdrawal. They're continually searching for it. Just because of that dopamine stuff and that chasing the high. And when they start to get better, it's a really cool thing, actually. So I get it that, you know, a lot of the people who end up in these circumstances aren't exactly the kind of people we want to take care of every day. But I've seen this in school teachers and professionals and in other counselors. I've even given it to other providers. So, you know, nobody is necessarily spared from this opioid epidemic. Okay, enough of the soapbox. Next slide. Well, this is the end. Pain's tough. and, you know, this is hard for many, many people. And I think this drug is really, it's really made a difference. So, anyway, that's what I have to say. Any questions, Marshall, or anybody?
Great. Thank you, Dr. Bertoli. Thanks for that wonderful presentation. So there are a couple of ways that you can ask questions. You can either raise your hand and I will unmute you, or you can type a question into the question box. So before we take questions, I just want to again put a plug in. Next week, we have a question and answer office hours where you can dial in. I think in two slides there's a dial-in information. You can dial in and have a candid conversation with Dr. Bertoli. Chew on what he told you this week, and if you come up with any questions, please call in and ask. That will be available for you as a resource. Also, we have applied for CMEs and CEs for this webinar. So if you are sitting in a group, please type in whoever else is with you at the computer, their name and their credentials. And then lastly, we're doing we have an evaluation at the end of this, and we really take your feedback, and we're trying to gauge what our next training opportunities will be. So if you have any input on that, please put that into the evaluation. So Dr. Bertoli, I have a few questions that have come in. I'll ask the first one. The question, this provider is seeing a patient on oxycodone and hydrocodone, who broke her medication agreement with a positive Utoc for methamphetamine. I can no longer prescribe her opiates. Is this the case for Suboxone, where Suboxone is possibly appropriate?
I think absolutely. I mean, what I try to do, first of all, is you try a taper so that people are only on one opioid. I a lot of people say I need something else for breakthrough pain or whatever. I just think that's nonsense because most people are at the point, most of those drugs, don't have the ceiling effect, and there's marginal increase in benefit from taking more drugs. But somebody who's abusing those drugs with methamphetamine is absolutely a good candidate for buprenorphine naloxone. The issue is, are they motivated and do they realize, are they willing to go through the process? And that's where I think relationship with people, trying to talk to them about their addiction is really important. And I think that case spills over from just pain to actually an addiction. So yeah, absolutely. That's exactly the person you want to put on the drug.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to unmute Danielle Denea. Sorry if I messed that up. Danielle, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay, great. Go ahead and ask your question.
Oh, mine was just a minor question. Do the pain management, because my clinician generally refers most of these patients to pain management clinics, and I'm curious to know if they utilize this drug.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of what I learned, I went to seminars with people who were pain specialists, certified by the American Academy of Addiction. And, but I think that, it's so commonplace in the patients that we see all the time that having somebody in your office, or maybe even sharing that, nobody wants to just see pain patients, but I think it's a huge problem in primary care. And having one or more people in your office who can prescribe, I think is really helpful. I think you have to have the temperament to do it. It's hard work. But the way I look at it is, if somebody comes in and their A1C is 15, we don't kick them out of the program and deny them insulin because their diabetes isn't in good control. And I kind of see this issue in the same way. It's a primary care issue. It's a chronic disease. And I think we ought to be addressing it in our offices. That's just my bias about it. And I think you can learn enough about the drug. I don't know nearly as much as Corey Waller does, but he does it day and night. I'm seeing patients with all kinds of other chronic illnesses. I think it can be, as I said, it can be very satisfying. So absolutely you can do it in your office.
Dr. Kubota. And when it comes to the pain specialist, some do and some don't. So have buprenorphine, buprenorphine group. And don't forget they're, at this point, limited to 100 patients per X license, although that number may double.
I didn't mention that, Marshall, but the first year you have your X license, you're limited to 30 patients. It goes up to 100 after the first year. And Congress has a lot of legislation in front of it to increase that to 200 to 300. And there's been a big lobby in the last few months about increasing that. So that's probably going to happen.
Yeah, and I think that's great. And then when you talk about having a couple of clinicians, that's, I think, obviously a good idea for backup and sharing the experience. We've heard of at least one clinic where they're going to train everybody in the office. I don't know what everybody means, but they want everybody to understand the Suboxone clinic, and I think that's a great idea.
Yeah. I'm just thinking having knowledge of it is really an important thing. The other issue that comes up is a lot of people will say, well, but it's still an opioid, and if you stopped it suddenly, you're going to go into withdrawal. There's no question about that. And, so some emphasis on alternative remedies. We are at RCMS and Wallala have just put together a group from our behavioral health staff and our other providers and some of our nurses to talk about how we can utilize other resources in the community, some of the alternative providers. We've had some sort of arguments about this because typically, we've practiced Western allopathic medicine, which is evidence-based, And a lot of things people do out there in communities, especially rural communities, aren't necessarily evidence-based. My attitude about that is, you know, first of all, do no harm. If people are doing things that can help people, we should utilize them. So we have lots of different practitioners who are trying to, you know, we put an article in the paper about this. We put patients on notice, and we asked community providers, other than medical providers, to, if they were interested, to contact us. And we put the ad in last week, and we're having a meeting this afternoon, and already three or four people have responded. So I think using your other resources is a good thing, and it's got to be good in the community because it brings you closer together. And people realize this isn't just a medical clinic's problem, it's a community problem that everybody has to participate in. So we'll see where that goes, but that's the, and what we're talking about doing is having each person come in and talk to our behavioral health counselor about their particular issue and what motivates them and what possible things we can do for them other than just prescribe opioids. And it's a lot of work, let me tell you, it's hard work, but I think, you know, we don't necessarily want to put everybody on the buprenorphine naloxone because they still have to taper off it. They still go into withdrawal if they stopped it suddenly, and it's still an opioid. It's just probably a better opioid than all the other ones out there. So, and I think it allows people to begin to rebuild their lives in a way that is productive. You know, where before, you know, people, some of these people have been taking drugs so long they can't get off the couch. There's no motivation to do anything, and you restore the dopamine level to something that's normal, and people stop being euphoric all the time, and they start to eat better, sleep better, have better relationships, and actually they become, you know, people in society who are productive again. So.
Thanks, Dr. Petroli. We have another question. So it's a two-parter. One, do local hospitals stock naloxone and in conjunction with the, or sorry, not naloxone, the buprenorphine mm-hmm. naloxone. And then in conjunction with that, how do your patients do if they go into the hospital for inpatient?
Right. So that's been a big issue because a lot of people don't stock it. A lot of hospitals don't stock it. So sometimes it comes up that let's say somebody's going in for surgery. You know, let's say they have cholelithiasis. They're going in to get their gallbladder out, or they're having some abdominal surgery or an orthopedic procedure. A lot of the physicians, especially the surgeons, neither have the license to prescribe nor do they understand the drug. So what we'll do is, in the short term, allow them to go back to the opioid, but it's very limited, okay? And we talk to the surgeon ahead of time. We talk to the people at the hospital. It'd be wonderful if they started to use it. Some of the dentists will, you know, they won't switch people out to another opioid. They'll use, we can oftentimes continue the buprenorphine and use anti-inflammatories, but it's been much harder in the hospital, especially with procedures. So that's what we do. We basically let them prescribe the drug for the duration of the hospitalization, and then they come back to us and we switch them back to the buprenorphine. I'd like it if a lot more emergency room doctors understood this drug, though, because I had two or three in the last month ER visits where it was prescribed and it really didn't do anything for the patient because they were already on the buprenorphine. So.
Great, thank you. Are there any other questions?
There was another part. You said it was two-part?
Oh, that was just how they did. One, if they stock it, and two, how they did patients.
And most patients, by the way, who have been on buprenorphine for a while, some of them will even say to the surgeon, I don't want the opioid. You know, I'm on buprenorphine, and I am okay with taking this for my pain. And we can get them that drug then. I mean, we can get it to the hospital, you know, because it's really for pain. And if they're on it already and they're having pain, it can be prescribed. You don't need the X license to do that. Just got to be careful about what the diagnosis is, you know. That's happened a couple of times where we just continued it for people who are having a procedure or having a lot of pain in the hospital.
Great, thank you. Are there any other questions? Dr. Kubota, did you have anything else to ask?
Well, you know, we're working with Dr. Bertoli because of his experience, and he is from a small clinic and has worked in a large FQHC as well, setting up the program. So has a lot of experience, and obviously, as you've heard, some common sense approaches as well. And so we're working with Dr. Bertoli in the, you know, the ability to provide technical assistance. We're still working on that, but we expect to be able to, based on schedules and all of that, try to get Dr. Bertoli out there a little bit if you have interest.
Yeah, I'd be happy, if time permits, to actually look at people's setup and try and help. I mean, I'm not an addiction specialist, but I've been doing it for a long time, and I think my approach to it, unlike the addiction specialist, is really practical. It's like, how do you get it done in a FQHC or a community clinic or people out there trying to, you know, help solve this problem? And I'd be happy to help.
Great, thanks. I have one more question. So do you have experience with heroin addicts using this?
Yes, lots of experience. It's interesting because, you know, heroin is, as the tap gets turned off for pills, and they get more expensive, especially on the street. I mean, the going rate that the last one I heard was like a 10 milligram oxycodone was $1 a milligram, so it's 10 bucks for a pill. As we as providers start to taper people off or use less and less, give fewer prescriptions, people are turning to heroin, and it's a much cheaper alternative. The problem is that, you know, since it's a street drug, it is often cut with various things like talc and other kinds of powders, and often you don't know how strong it is. So I had a heroin addict come to me maybe a month or two ago, and he said, you know, heroin out here in the Bay Area, or where, you know, Mendocino County, is much less strong than what I was getting in Pennsylvania. It was more pure back there. So what I found is that I had to use more and more to get the same sort of results. Now, that's really dangerous, because that purity of the what he's taking is going to change. You know, it could be next week, it'd be a lot more pure than it was this week. And if he gives himself a bigger dose, he has a huge risk of overdosing. And almost all the overdoses are because these drugs are respiratory depressants. Most people die a respiratory death. There's a big move out there to make naloxone, either injectably or I think you can snort it as well, an over-the-counter medicine at some of the pharmacies with a reasonable price. You know, what's hard about that is if you're a heroin addict and you overdose, I'm not sure you'd have the wherewithal to give yourself the injection, but maybe somebody could find it in your pocket and give it to you or something. But I've treated quite a few heroin addicts, and I think it's very, very effective for those people. It's worked really well. Because a lot of times people who are heroin addicts are just doing it because they're addicts. They're not doing it because they have pain or any other issue. And I've had a lot of success with heroin addicts.
Great, thanks.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
Because you mentioned naloxone, I just want to quickly let everyone who's on the webinar know that Partnership has purchased nasal atomizers, and we are working with sites to set up site-level naloxone programs. So if you're interested in that, please either send me an email. I'll send out a follow-up email after this webinar so you can respond to that, or you can type into the chat box now. Quickly, Danielle Denias, do you have another question? I'm going to unmute you.
Well, actually, I just needed clarification, because early in the presentation, Doctor, you had mentioned that once on that medication, then those, the narcotics that they previously were on were not going to be as effective or not have that same
As long as somebody's using the buprenorphine, that has a greater affinity for those receptors, those opioid receptors, than any other opioid. So if they've got the drug on board, the other drugs aren't going to work because they don't have the strength to push the buprenorphine off the receptor.
Right.
What I said was the converse isn't true, okay? The buprenorphine will fight the other opioid for the receptor, and the consequences both come off, and that's what precipitates withdrawal. That's why they have to be in withdrawal when they come in.
What I needed clarification on is then if we have a patient on that particular medication and they do go in for surgery, then we should probably be notifying the surgeon of the situation so that they, because if they're just going to provide them with the same type of narcotics for the pain afterwards, it's not going to be.
Right. So what they have to do is probably stop the buprenorphine for a day or so. And when they start to go in withdrawal or have more pain, then you give them the other drug. That's how you do that. I mean, the buprenorphine is not going to stay on the receptor forever.
And, right.
You know, start to see, you will withdraw. You will very definitely withdraw from buprenorphine as well. So all that cow stuff still applies. And if they're in withdrawal and they're going for surgery, just give them the other drug.
I see what you're saying. Okay. Just needed that clarification.
Great. Well, thank you, everyone.
I'd be happy to, talk more questions next week, or, people, you can give my email if you need to, Danny, and I'm happy to talk to people about this.
Great. I will. Thank you, Dr. Bertoli. So just quickly, on the partnership webpage, there's the MPS webpage. On the partnership website, there's the MPS webpage. And this webinar has been recorded. Within a week or two, this will be put on the webpage under past events, so it'll be readily available. And there's also a slew of other information on that webpage. There's a naloxone toolkit, a pharmacy toolkit, a PCP toolkit, and quite a few other resources as well. And then just again, this is the information for the question and answer session next week. If you guys think of any other questions that you have, if you want to have a more informal conversation, please call in between noon and 12:30. This is a small test of change. We've never done this before. So if no one calls in by maybe 12:15, then we'll probably get off the line. So just try to call in around noon and have your questions answered and have a candid discussion with Dr. Bertoli on this. And then lastly, this is my contact information. So if you have any other questions about the Managing Pain Safety Project, or if you are interested in getting nasal atomizers for your site, or if you have other questions for Dr. Bertoli, please feel free to email me, and I will get back to you. So thank you, everyone, for joining the webinar. And thank you, Dr. Bertoli, for presenting today.
Okay.